Welcome to Northern Latitudes. I'm Bill Ault. Today's guest has spent a lifetime saying yes. Yes to curiosity, yes to risk, yes to exploring places and ideas. He's turned questions into a career. In his new memoir, Just Say Yes, our guest reflects on a life guided by wonder and chance. It's a deeply human story from someone who's inspired millions to look up, look around, and keep asking questions. You will recognize his voice instantly. For decades, he's been a trusted companion on CBC radio and TV, guiding us through black holes, quantum physics, and the mysteries of our own backyard. Please welcome broadcaster, author, host of CBC's Quirks and Quarks, Bob McDonald. Welcome to Northern Latitudes, Bob.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for the invitation. Pleasure to be here.
The power of yes. Would you say yes was something you developed, saying yes, developed as you went through life, or was it something that was always there?
Well, that's a good question. It came about because people opened doors of opportunity for me and said, hey, why don't you try that? You'd be good at it. And for whatever reason, I said yes. And then they gave me a pat on the back after I did that to say, keep going, you're doing well. And it just has always been. But at the same time, when I was a kid, I liked to be outside a lot. I lived in Orillia, Gordon Lightfoot's territory. In fact, my older sister dated him in high school.
There's some trivia.
Yeah, but it was very much an outdoor experience in the lake during the summertime and playing around in the snow in the wintertime. So I spent a lot of time with friends, but also by myself, just exploring the world. And I found that there's a real thrill to that, to just going out and seeing what's out there and not being afraid of it.
And you talk about many of your yes moments in the book. What was one of the key ones, though, for it to get you on the path that you ended up taking?
I guess the one that really changed my life the most was saying yes to a suggestion that my girlfriend in 1973, Debbie Poole, she made to me that the Ontario Science Centre in Toronto was looking for people to do the demonstrations, standing hair up with static electricity, freezing flowers in liquid nitrogen, burning holes through bricks with a giant laser. And it was something that I had been to the Science Centre. I saw it, thought it was just fabulous, and wanted to do that. So I was a construction worker at the time, and I drove my truck to the Science Center. It took some company time and met the guy who was hiring, and I just talked his ear off. I said, I'd love to work here. I've always loved science. I grew up in the space age and watched all the moon landings, and I've had some theater experience, and this brings the two of them together, theater and science. I love it. I don't even know what I said. And then he just stopped me mid-sentence, and he said, you're the kind of person we'd like to have here. And he hired me on the spot, on pure enthusiasm. And that changed my life. I went from being a blue-collar worker to wearing a white lab coat and impressing crowds and learning how to communicate science in a fun way, have a sense of humor about it, make it real. And the lessons that I learned at the Science Center set me off on my whole career in broadcasting. So that was probably the biggest change that came about in my life.
And where did the love of science come from?
Well, growing up in the space age, you know, the whole space age happened in my lifetime. I remember Sputnik, the very first satellite, living in Orillia as a little kid. The Packet and Times, which was the newspaper at the time, the front page had this drawing of the Earth and a circle around it and a little ball. And it said, Russians launch first artificial moon. And I thought, wow, that was really great. This space, there's this satellites. And then I followed all the early astronauts. I knew all their names. Yuri Gagarin, the first person in space, John Glenn and Alan Shepard, Neil Armstrong. I watched all those missions. I watched all six moon landings, not just the first one. There were six landings. I watched them all. And I was just fascinated by this whole idea that humans were leaving the Earth and going to another world. And I figured by the time 2025 came around, I'd be taking holidays on the moon and maybe even going to Mars. That hasn't quite happened yet. But that's really what inspired me, was just seeing this amazing thing that we did, where we invented brand new technology to get off the planet. So science delivered us somewhere new, and I was always fascinated by that.
It's fascinating. You know, we all grew up thinking about flying cars. I mean, I'm not quite as old as you, but, you know, it's one of those things that was imprinted in our mind by Apollo and the moon landings. Do you think that still exists for kids?
Oh, sure. And we need that kind of futuristic thinking, you know, like Disneyland, they had World of Tomorrow, where they had all the flying cars, or the Jetsons cartoon series, where everything was up in the sky. And that's fabulous. And we are actually seeing flying cars now. There are these one person drones. And they have like blades, four, six, or eight blades on them. And they can lift a person off the ground. And they're starting to buzz around. And people are flying them. They're not quite at home yet. They're not commercial, you know, widely available. But they're there. The ability to lift off from your front yard and fly around is already here. And it's going to be interesting to see how that stuff takes off, literally.
Yeah. And going back to the very beginning, life in Aurelia. The story is very, it's one of these books I read and I think, gee, I wish I'd read this book when I was 20 years old. But when you grew up in Aurelia, you didn't grow up rich. You grew up in a poor, your university career did not turn out the way one would think. I think when you think back as a person on the outside, you think, oh, Bob must have a degree in something, and you don't.
No.
So tell me a little bit about early life and school and what all happened along the way, because it's just not what people expect.
Yeah, I know. People are always asking me, where did you get your PhD? And I say, no, I don't have a PhD. I don't have any official degree. And that's because I was a terrible student all the way through school. Teachers would always put on my report card, Bobby can do better. And I barely got above 50% all the way through school. I don't know. I just wasn't good. My home life in Aurelia was kind of a Jekyll and Hyde way of life. Neither of my parents were well educated. They both were work laborers. And my dad was an alcoholic, a very serious alcoholic, an abusive alcoholic. And that's why we were low income. We weren't poor, but we were the poor people on the block. And it gives you this sense that we couldn't do what other families did. We couldn't take vacations to Disneyland or even go out to restaurants or things like that. They were both struggling just to keep food on the table. And my dad kept losing jobs because he drank so much. So home was a very troubled place for me, a place to be from. And that's why I spent so much time outside, is getting away from home, because I never knew who would be there when I got home, whether it be Dr. Jekyll or Mr. Hyde. And when it was Mr. Hyde, it was pretty awful. So that was my background, and I didn't have good study habits at home. So school to me was not really great. Where I did do well in school, in university, and I did manage to hang on for 2 years, but I failed my second year and then dropped out, was theater. In high school, I got the lead in Oklahoma, the musical, you know, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. I did all that. And I did some Shakespeare in university. I played Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream, which is a comic role, which I really like. And people told me that, hey, you should be an actor. You'd be really good at this. And I thought about it. But then I realized that to be an actor, you have to audition. You have to compete with other people. And my inferiority complex, feeling like I'm not good enough, took over. And I thought, I don't want to be rejected. I don't want to be told I'm not good enough if I don't get a part. So I kind of avoided acting. On the other hand, my career now as a science journalist, I regularly give talks in front of big audiences. So there I am up on stage, but I'm speaking my own words and not someone else's. So my theater experience has really helped in my communication of science. And I've had to learn science along the way, thanks to mentors and people who've taken me under their wing and a whole lot of reading to catch up. So I guess I got an education in a different way than through the school system, but somehow it worked.
Just mentioned inferiority complex, and in the book, right in the introduction, you talk about imposter syndrome. So you hooked me instantly, like that, because I think a lot of us go through that, no matter what walks of life we're in. Has that slowly changed for you, or do you still wake up some days and go, "How did I end up here, and what am I doing?"
Oh, that still happens. I pinch myself every now and then, you know, and I feel very privileged to do what I do. But yeah, the imposter syndrome is there, because I would show up on television programs and I'd be talking about space. I'd have things, props in my hands. I'd be working with Peter Mansbridge on the National, answering questions from the audience, and people think I'm really smart. But in fact, I never mentioned that I didn't have an official degree. I never called myself a scientist. The host sometimes did. They say, "Oh, you're a science guy," you know. But I never called myself a science, and tried to keep that back, you know. What I say is more important. What I'm telling you is more important than where I came from. And I'll give you an example of where that really paid off. Another time that I said yes, I was at a space mission in California. I wanted to follow the missions to the planets, the robotic missions to the planets. And I was there covering a mission to Saturn. And the public relations person from NASA came up to me with a package and said, "Are you interested in Venus?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." She said, "Yeah, we sent a spacecraft to Venus too, but nobody seems to care. Here, we've seen through the clouds of Venus for the first time." I said, "That's historic. We've never seen through the clouds of Venus." She said, "I know. Here, these are the first maps of Venus." So when I came back to Toronto, at that time, the Globe and Mail had a science page every Thursday. And I figured, this is such a big story, they're going to have this. So that Thursday, I went, I got a Globe and Mail, and it wasn't there. So I called the Globe and Mail up and I said, "Do you have a science editor?" They said, "Yep, just a minute." I get this guy on the phone. I say, "Are you doing anything on Pioneer Venus?" He said, "What's that?" I said, "Are you kidding? I just came back from NASA. They've seen through the clouds of Venus. I have this press kit and all the maps of Venus. You should be doing this story." And he said, "Why don't you do it?" I said, "Me?" He said, "Yeah, write it up, send it in. If I don't like your writing, I'll publish the pictures and give you a credit. I'm really busy. Got to go. Bye." Well, I'd never written for the Globe and Mail, or, you know, like, what the heck? So I thought, how am I going to do this? And I was intimidated by it, but I called up someone I knew who worked in print. And I said, "Is there a formula for newspapers, the structure they use?" And she said, "Yeah, there's this thing called an inverted pyramid. It's the structure they use." So she explained that to me. So I sat down and I wrote Venus Revealed, Bob and Donald, blah, blah, blah. And I told the history of how we haven't known what Venus is like, what the spacecraft did. Then I went to the guy in person. And I said, "Hi, I'm the guy with the Venus story. Here's the press kit. Here's my story. Here's why it's important." He said, "Great, I'll get back to you." Okay. So I left there thinking, who am I to think I could write for the Globe and Mail? This is crazy. He's going to hate it. And he didn't get back to me. And the following Thursday, I thought, okay, he threw it away. I went and I got a Globe and Mail. I opened it up and the whole top section was Venus Revealed by Bob McDonald. He printed the whole thing. So I called him back. I said, "Hey, thanks for publishing my Venus story." He said, "You're welcome. Do you have any more?" And I went, "Yeah, sure." He said, "Great. Send them in. Got to go. Bye." He never said, "Who are you? Where did you go to school? What was your degree? Who's your teachers?" None of that. I had a good idea. I had a good idea. And that's what works, is good ideas. And I try to tell young people that. If you want to do something, just do it. Don't just give an application form to whatever organization. Give them an idea. And that works. And it's worked for me again and again over the years where I've wanted to do something. So I've hit the imposter syndrome does come up, but I've also found that if you just get things done, finish what you start after you say yes, finish what you start. And people really appreciate that. And you get better as you go.
Are there any other individuals along the way that really influenced how this all turned out for you?
Yes. A space artist named John Lomberg, who did space art for Carl Sagan, the famous astronomer who inspired a lot of people, did a television series called Cosmos. John and I shared a house in Toronto, and John introduced me to Carl Sagan and also invited me down to the launch of Voyager, which was a spacecraft that was sent out to Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and is now crossing our galaxy. John was involved in a golden record that's on the side of Voyager that's a message to anyone who might be out there. And he worked with Carl on that. So he introduced me to Carl Sagan and the whole Voyager mission. But he also introduced me to CBC because John was doing documentaries for CBC Radio. And he asked me if I would like to try one. And he introduced me to the program Ideas to do a one-hour documentary on, get this, climate change. 1977, we were doing climate change. So he showed me how to do it, how to do an interview, how to cut audio tape, and how to put this thing together. And I did that. And the producer of the series said, hey, that was great. Do you want to do your own series next year? Yes, I would. So the following year, I did 5 hours on geology, earthquakes and volcanoes, called Earth Profile of a Planet. So now I'm a documentary writer and producer just by saying yes. So John influenced me a lot. He introduced me to the robotic space program and CBC Radio, and I can't thank him enough for that.
Do you remember your first Quirks and Quarks?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I was terrified. Up until I joined Quirks and Quarks in 1992, everything that I had done was my own. I had done documentaries. I was a freelance writer-broadcaster, and I was the host of a television children's show called Wonderstruck. It was a science show for kids, and we had a lot of fun, and I was also one of the producers on that. So it was all new. It was I was the only host of that show right from the very beginning. Quirks and Quarks was the first time that I stepped into someone else's shoes. The show had already been on the air for quite a while, almost 20 years. David Suzuki was the first host. And then Jay Ingram was the host for 12 years. Both of them very, very accomplished and well-educated science journalists. So I was quite intimidated by that. And I had to find out the Quirks way of doing things, which was very different from children's television. And also that first year was when the British had mad cow disease that came out. So I had to learn how to say bovine spongiform encephalopathy, which is the name of mad cow disease. And I had to learn all these hard, hard stuff. Quirks goes deep, you know. So it was pretty intimidating, my first show. I was quite nervous about it. But along the way, I've learned to fit in.
and your own innate curiosity about science and scientific things seems to be as active now as it was 30 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have to, is that natural? Does it just keep coming for you? Or do you think about it sometimes?
Oh, I think about it a lot, because science is just trying to understand how the universe works. And as someone who likes to travel, you know, I've been completely around the world. I've been all over the planet, and I love going to new places and seeing things I've never seen before, finding out about them, not just the culture and the people, but the geography or the climate or whatever. And science does that. It's just trying to figure out, you know, why is the sky blue? Why are leaves green? How big is the universe? How old is it? And there's still a lot we don't know. In fact, we don't know 95% of the universe. Dark energy and dark matter, they don't have a clue what those two things are, and yet they make up 95% of the universe. So there's still a lot to learn. And I feel really privileged to work on a program where every week I talk to scientists who just found out something new. And it doesn't matter what it is. Sometimes it's something really, really small, like, I don't know, the sex life of some insect. Or it might be looking out to the edge of the universe and the formation of galaxies right after the Big Bang. It could be anything, but it's all new. And I feel like a surfer riding on the cutting edge of our knowledge as we penetrate ignorance. And it's eternally fascinating. So that's what's great to me, is it's just curiosity about the universe and the world at large. And I never lose interest in that.
And science right now, to say science is under attack a bit, would that be fair? And
yes.
How do you see that ending up?
I'm very concerned about that. When I started out and when I was a kid, scientists were like magicians. They were doing wondrous things, you know, and I was acting like a magician when I'd take a flower and put it in liquid nitrogen for 2 seconds and then it would be totally frozen. You know, wow, that's really great. And kids would be all excited about it. But now there are other interests that don't want to hear what science has to say, that don't want to hear that science is telling us the climate is warming up, because the industries that are at the root of that are making a whole lot of money right now and they don't want to change. They want to keep things the same. And that's very dangerous. And they're spreading misinformation and disinformation. Misinformation is when you put out something and you don't know you've made a mistake. That's misinformation. Okay, everybody does that. Disinformation is when you're intentionally trying to deceive the public. And there's a lot of disinformation there about climate change, about green energy, about all kinds of things that are not scientific, but they're confusing the public. And they're saying that the science is wrong. And I'm very worried about that, because science not only points to the issues that we have to face, like climate change, water shortages, droughts, food supply, population growth, all that, it also points to sensible solutions. I wrote a whole book about that called The Future Is Now, Solving the Climate Crisis with Today's Technologies. Because all the technology to go green, to keep the lights on, to turn wheels, to move from here to there without harming the environment already exists. We can capture the energy of the sun and the wind and the heat of the earth and the tide. We know how to do that, but we're not. And one of the big reasons we're not is because the old guard, the system that's already in place, is telling us, oh, it's going to break the economy. We can't afford to do it and all that, when in fact we can. So there needs to be education. We need to know the difference between real science and pseudoscience or conspiracy theories. And it's hard because they're really good at it. In many cases, they're better at it than we who are trying to communicate the science. So I'm very concerned about that, that we might be led into a feeling that, oh, don't worry about it, there's really no problem, while the problem is getting worse. And sometimes I feel like I'm on the Titanic after it struck the iceberg, and there's lifeboats for everyone. And the captain's saying, okay, man the lifeboats. And most people are getting in. But then there are people still on deck saying, hey, I've heard those lifeboats are dangerous. Where were they made? Were they made in China? I don't like the color. I'm not getting in a lifeboat. I'm going to stay here on deck. The boat hasn't sunk yet. We're fine. We're comfortable. It's cold out there. I don't want to get in a lifeboat. That's what it feels like. And meanwhile, you know, things are changing. So I'm not a doom and gloomer, but we need to start acting to change it. I believe we can. I'm actually optimistic that we can engineer our way through these issues that we're facing right now, but we have to believe the science to get there. So let's do that.
And it was interesting because I listened to the latest episode of Quirks and Quarks this morning on my drive in, and you had a story about science kind of being attacked from within.
Yes.
Like with the paper mills, or what do they call them? Sorry.
Yeah. Scientific fraud. Yeah. It's a big issue. It's a big issue. And, you know, it's too bad. It's too bad because science in its purest form is one of the last institutions we have that seeks the truth. It just wants to know, how do things work? That's it. It's not judgmental. It's just, how do things work in its purest form? But it can also be abused, used for nefarious purposes. So it bothers me that organizations that are not telling the truth are attacking the one that is. That bothers me a lot.
And what would you say to, because I know you started your work at the Ontario Science Center working with kids, and what would you say to kids these days about science and what it means and where it can take them?
Well, I would like to reassure them, because a lot of young people are afraid of the future. They're hearing about all these horrible things that are coming down the line with climate change and hurricanes getting stronger and all of that. And I would like to encourage them to say, you know, there are solutions out there. There are practical solutions out there. Learn your science and you'll find out about them. And then you will be the decision makers in the future to put those into action so that we can move forward and prevent these horrible things from happening. So don't be afraid of the future, embrace it, but learn the science first.
And where's Just Say Yes taking Bob McDonald next?
Well, I'm going to keep doing Quirks and Quarks until they tell me not to. I'm writing another book for kids called There's a Hole Through the Earth. What would happen if you jumped into a hole that went right through the earth? So to get an idea of what the planet's like on the inside. I'm also considering another book based on a speech that I give called What If Everything We Know Is Wrong? On how science has shown us that the way we see the world is not always right. It keeps correcting us, sort of the history of science. I just started a brand new life with a brand new beautiful person. And so I'm just got myself married, so nice. Which is kind of neat. And we're starting a whole new life. Still travel, still drive motorcycles. Going to be heading to the European Alps this summer to see an eclipse of the sun in Spain. So I just want to keep traveling, keep exploring the world, and keep having a good time. Life's too short.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. That was wonderful.
Pleasure talking to you, Bill.
That's it for this episode. Thanks to Bob McDonald for taking the time to talk to me today. Just Say Yes is published by Douglas & McIntyre and available wherever you source your books. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a review on your favorite listening platform to stay updated on future episodes. For even more Northern Latitudes content, including the podcast archives, my photography, and Northern Latitudes events, go to northernlatitudes.ca. Theme music and sound logo produced and performed by John Sanfilippo of Soundwise in Kingston. Closing music is called Innovation by Jay Carr. To leave a comment or suggestion, email me at podcast@northernlatitudes.ca. Until next time, I'm Bill Ault. Find your way to Northern Latitudes.